session number 6095, reel 2.
Mr. Foinette, reel 2.
The only bit of Germany I saw was really on the way down from Odense to Frankfurt. We were at Hamburg. We went into the waiting room and we were served with coffee and with the German service personnel who were obviously changing trains there. And I don't think really that it was very different from any wartime place in England at the time. Of course, we'd heard a lot about the effects of our bombing, but there was very little evidence of it that I saw at the time, and I think they were just carrying on normally. They were still very, very much on top of the world, and there was no grounds for them to be despondent, I think.
Where was Spangenberg, the first prison camp to which you were taken?
It was a medieval castle near Kassel. And it was most of the people there were senior officers, army officers, who had been captured at Dieppe, no, at
Dunkirk,
yes, and Saint-Omer and places like that in 1940.
What impression did you get of the state of morale there?
They were a little bit down. They'd been prisoners for 2 years or more. And the first thing they did was to get hold of us to find out how things were going. And we naturally gave them very optimistic reports of all the doings that were going on and how well we were doing, despite the fact that we'd just lost Singapore and the Japs had entered the war. We put a very brave face on it, as a matter of fact, we did during the whole of the war. Despite all the reverses, it was most extraordinary that very rarely did any prisoner of war appear to think that we were going to lose the war. So, of course, our message to all these colonels and above was that, we might be home by Christmas, and that was Christmas 42. We were sure everything was going to be all right. Possibly with the advent of a number of Air Force youngsters in their midst, we also helped to boost their morale, although our behaviour was not in accordance with the army discipline, because we were the most undisciplined lot they'd probably ever come across. But they were obviously very glad to see us, and by and large, I think their morale was quite good, despite the fact they'd suffered quite a lot of hardships for the first year or so. They'd got nothing in the way of Red Cross parcels, but they'd settled down into a good routine.
Was there any friction between the newcomers and the long-standing PRWs?
No, I don't think so. There might have been a few individual cases. We were very boisterous and we upset them from that point of view, insofar that they'd settled for a very quiet existence. And here were a lot of schoolboys who were not amenable to discipline, because the RAF were notorious for possibly being a little bit boisterous in their activities, whether in officers' messes or in prison camps. And while we felt that we were probably bringing them a breath of fresh air, they didn't think so, because they didn't like being disturbed. And as we got older as prisoners of war, I can sympathise with them, because we probably started to get the same way with when newcomers came into our camp.
Why were you put in with the Army top brass?
I don't know. The very early on in the war, Spangenberg had been used. And then they also had a lower camp down in the village of Spangenberg, where quite a number of the RAF people had gone just before I was shot down. And they were all moved up into this upper camp in the castle just before we went there. And I suppose it was just one of these things that the Germans were looking around for available accommodation pending the completion of the Stalag Luft III at Sagen.
What was accommodation like in the castle?
Fairly primitive. We had 40 of us in one large room. Of course, the castle has always been used as a prisoner of war camp, from the sort of Franco-Prussian wars and things like that. And whereas many of the senior officers had comparatively small rooms, we were stuck in this very large room, which we all called the Arab quarters. And it had toilet facilities and a wash basin just off it. And I think there were about 40 of us there. We had one very well-known gentleman, the wing commander Stanford Tuck, as a member of our group, and Marcus Marsh, who was a racehorse trainer. He was there. And the food was not very good, but it was adequate, obviously. And we, of course, had very little extra to what we were shot down in at the time. But the Red Cross parcels did start to come in, and we got things like cigarettes, and the army officers were very good in sharing out what came in.
Why were they called the Arab quarters?
I think it's just because we probably because the state of our existence there, we were sort of possibly because we were fairly scruffy. One rather amusing thing occurred there was that there were several ideas of escaping. Of course, there were a few escapes from the castle at various times during the war, partly by dressing up as German officers and marching through the gates. That was before the Germans got very fly on our activities. Another crowd went out dressed in civilian clothes, which they'd managed to scrounge, as part of the Swiss Red Cross Commission. The Swiss Red Cross arrived to inspect the camp, and two officers went out dressed as in civvies, and they were allowed out as by the guards, who'd changed, incidentally, thinking that they were the bona fide Swiss Commission people. But the Air Force, our crowd, none of ours got out. We had all sorts of hair-raising ideas of getting across the moat. There was a large moat round this castle, which they used to keep wild boar in the olden days, but there weren't any there while we were there, and eventually we were allowed to use it as a bit of a garden. But the biggest problem was to getting over to the moat. And one chap had a hair-raising scheme of making a little trolley and going down over the electricity wires across to the other side. But he hadn't worked out how to get over the sag, and also the fact that probably the wires would have given way and he'd have dropped about 60 feet into the moat. But during the course of one of the searches in the room, which the Germans kept on making, we had a very large round table in the middle with a big pedestal leg to it. And when they decided to take this to pieces, and they found some grappling irons in there, complete with ropes and everything else. And as we'd not found it, we think that it must have been there from the First World War. But we were very upset when they discovered these, because I think we'd have put them to good use.
Did they accuse you of having made them?
No, they accepted the fact that they were there.
So none of these escape attempts succeeded, in that no one got back to Britain?
No.
How long were you at Spangenberg?
We were there for, I think, two to three months, because we've then moved to Sagen, which was opened, I think, in May 1942.
Were there any other nationalities of POW in Spangenberg?
Yes, there were French officers, and there were a number of French orderlies, and I don't think there were many. I can't recall any Poles there. There may have been, but offhand, I can't recall whether there were any Poles. No. As far as I'm concerned, as far as I'm aware, they were basically British with just a sprinkling of French.
How did the British and French get on with each other?
Well, we didn't have a great... the Air Force didn't have a great deal to do with them. One or two of them made friends. In fact, there was one, I think, squadron leader, Tommy Calnan, who was a very young photographic reconnaissance unit pilot who'd got shot down. I think he made friends with them, and they investigated the attics up in the above us, and I think that's where he learnt to pick locks, which he used later on in one of his escapades out. And incidentally, they found quite a lot of equipment up in the attic, which we hope to put to good use.
What type of equipment?
I think clothing, and which had been stuck up there for some reason or other, I don't know why, and left there. It had all been locked up, and the Germans, in their wisdom, thought that nobody could break locks, and so they were quite safe.
So what use is it put to?
Well, we had anticipated using it, of course, for making escapes, provided we could find a way of getting out of the castle. They started to tighten up on security, so naturally the chances of getting out of the castle reduced accordingly. They introduced tallies, for example, of people coming in and out, so you couldn't get in. You couldn't get out without having reproduced the tally which had been given you for the guards.
Were the French treated in exactly the same way as the British by the Germans?
Oh, yes. Yes, we were just locked in this castle and left to our own devices. Just food brought in by orderlies.
But were the French in separate accommodation?
Yes, they had their own area of living.
Can you tell me how you came to leave Spangenberg?
Yes, well, we got our usual marching orders. The Germans came in at the usual 5 minutes notice and sort of said, right, pack up your goods, you're on the way. We were then marched down into the town and put in the usual cattle trucks, 40 to a truck, and locked in, of course. They did put a form of latrine in it. Field officers of field rank, squadron leader and above, they were given accommodation in the ordinary passenger compartments on the train. And then we were just shunted through the countryside until we came to Sargon, which is in Silesia.
Can you describe your first impressions of Sargon?
Well, it's the camp was obviously specially built, and there were timber huts in a large clearing of in pine woods. I think we were about a mile from the station. All the huts were built above ground. The Germans, having learned that if they put huts on the ground from previous camps, that they were ideal for tunnelling and couldn't be seen. Of course, you just ripped up the floorboards and tunnelled from underneath.
How do you mean they were above ground?
Well, they were all put up on little timber piles. So every hut was about 2 feet above the ground, just on these piles. So that any tunnelling, of course, would then be seen, because the German ferrets, as we call the special guards used for searching for tunnels and illicit contraband, which we acquired, they used to crawl under the huts looking for signs of any digging. And it was all sand. So any tunnels which we had, which we then started to do, of course, were... we had to think of better ideas, and if we did actually do a tunnel, we had to sink a shaft, and to do that we removed the top sand, which by that time was dry and much lighter than the rest, and that was set aside. Then we went down through the damp sand and put a trapdoor in, and then put the dry sand back on top of the trapdoor so that it wouldn't appear that anybody had been underneath it. The ferrets then discovered that we knew their tricks, so they used to put little bits of paper down in various places, so then we had to be very circumspect as to where these little bits of paper or anything extraneous was on the site of our tunnel. They then started to put cotton and things like that so that we broke it. So we had to replace all that. And generally it was a very good cat and mouse game whereby we had to be one step ahead of the ferrets.
Couldn't they use the system of having iron rods to probe down into the sand?
Oh yes, they did that. But of course, with a limited headroom, we started to put our trapdoors that much deeper so that if they only had probes about a foot or 18 inches long, they probably didn't push it down quite far enough.
So what accommodation were you put into in Sagan?
Well, to start with, the huts we had, I think it was six to eight in a room. They were fairly smallish rooms, but adequate for about eight people. And we had double bunks with wooden bedboards. Each had its own little heating stove. And there were no washing facilities or toilet facilities in there. They had outside toilets, which were just dug in the ground, and they form of seats for put over the trenches, and made little cubicles for that. There was a certain amount of privacy in the officers' toilets, and the washrooms were separate, where we had a number of cold taps, and we rigged up our own cold showers. But really, considering that we were uninvited guests of the Germans, I think the accommodation they provided was pretty good. And until we moved, they then built, as the bombing increased in volume, of course, the number of prisoners started to increase. So this camp had to be expanded, and eventually they built another compound, which was the North Compound. This was the East Compound, the first one we went into, and the sergeant's air crew were in the next compound to us, which was known as the Centre Compound, and they were living in open barracks, actually, so that they would probably had 200 or 300 to a barrack block. But at the time, there was a certain amount of communication between us and the sergeants, and when they put on a show, groups of us from the East Compound were allowed to go over and be part of the audience. The same with the odd football match. And some of the sergeants were allowed over to some of our shows, which were put on in a small hut, which was converted into a theatre.
Was there nobody below the rank of sergeant there?
No, because all our crew were sergeant and above. I don't know the actual content of the sergeant's compound, but there may have been one or two leading aircraftsmen, because at the beginning of the war, some of the flying crew were ordinary leading aircraftsmen. The rear gunners, for example, on bombers, hadn't been elevated to the rank of sergeant by the outbreak of war, and so there were a number of people captured as LACs. Now, I don't know whether or not they were promoted to sergeants or whether they held their LAC rank.
Was that anybody therefore required to work from the RAF?
No. Air crew were generally not allowed to work, particularly in the Air Force, because, as I said, we were comparatively lone rangers in our flying, and therefore they considered that we had a certain amount of individuality, and therefore we were more likely to cause trouble or escape if we were given any freedom. So, by and large, all air crew were locked up in security camps.
Did you personally ever go outside the wire whilst you were in a German prison camp?
Once in 1944. There were the Germans, after a while, did institute a few walks outside, provided parole was given, and the senior British officer agreed that we were allowed to give parole to go on these walks. And I was one of the lucky ones and went out for about 2.5 hours in the surrounding area. Of course, parole didn't mean that you didn't keep your eyes open, so obviously those who went out had their eyes open for anything that might be suitable, or any routes which might be suitable should one get out unofficially. But in the main, they took us into the countryside and we went nowhere near the town, so the information which one could gain from a walk was very little.
Did you therefore have no contact with German civilians apart from the guards?
None at all. Except one or two people did manage to have, I believe one person met, Pole met his sister, who came to the wire, and she was able to shout a message across, because we were actually in Poland, what is now Poland. But otherwise, there was absolutely no contact with civilians, unless you went outside.
Were you able to keep in touch whilst you were in Sargon with the progress of the war?
Oh, yes. We very quickly got the equipment for radio sets, and every night we used to get the BBC News, which was then relayed to all the members of the camping groups.
How was the equipment obtained?
By blackmail. The German guards were amenable to blackmail, and eventually they reached the stage where, of course, they couldn't resist blackmail. The chief idea was that any German-speaking prisoner was encouraged to talk to the German guards, and many of them were family men, and so it was a matter of time before they were able to offer them cigarettes or chocolate for their children or coffee. And once they had accepted that, they were virtually in our clutches. And we then increased our demands and said, oh, well, now you've had these things, and of course you know what would happen if the commandant heard about it. We want such and such a bit of equipment. And from there we got bits and pieces for radio sets, cameras, photographic equipment. So from that point of view, we were able to make our own identity cards for anybody who was escaping. And as I say, we had several radios, because we always had two or three in case the Germans managed to unearth one. And in actual fact, to put them off the scent, on one occasion, we deliberately left one in a little bit more conspicuous spot than we normally did. And they found it, of course, were highly delighted. But we'd got two or three others tucked away somewhere else. So we think it served a purpose, at least for taking us out of the hot seat for the time being.
Were any of the guards discovered by their superiors in the process of being corrupted in this way?
I think eventually several were. Because if they were caught with the stuff on them, of course, that was curtains for them. But sometimes, I said that we never had any contact with civilians, but of course we did occasionally have a chap like a chimney sweep coming in, or somebody to repair a window or something like that. And on one occasion, they decided that they would put up loudspeakers so we could listen to the German news of all their victories and their martial music, which they are very fond of. So they sent in some civilians to put in cables from the their transmitting set. And he arrived complete with ladders and everything else, and coils of cable. This was at the time when, of course, we were doing our big tunnels from the north compound. And he was distracted for a short while, and he'd be given a cup of coffee or something or other, and his ladder disappeared, and most of his cable. And of course, when the tunnel, he didn't report these, of course. When the tunnels were eventually discovered after the Great Escape, of course, these things were found, and he was executed as a result. So I have no doubt that several of the German guards probably received similar treatment.
Can you tell me what you saw and heard of the Great Escape?
Well, I was in the actual camp itself, and we all knew the flat was on. All the people who were due to go out, who had anything concrete to do with escaping, were selected, and of course they included a number of people who hadn't been involved in escape, such as the bigwigs in the entertainment world, because it was considered that they'd contributed a lot to the life of camp, and but they, because of that, they hadn't been able to indulge in the activities of digging tunnels, etc. So a group of them were included, together with one or two more important bods who we considered were essential to get home. So they were all given allocated numbers on the escape to go out in a certain order. And then all the rest of the camp were moved around so that the main block from which the tunnel started was empty of any people who were not involved, so that all the escapees moved into that block for the particular night. Of course, we all had to keep a low profile and go about as if nothing was happening, naturally. Otherwise, the slightest slip-up of it on any part would have possibly alerted the Germans that the escape was on. And it was important that it could only occur on that particular night because of all the documents had to be dated, and that took some hours to do. So once the escape had been decided on, all the documents were dated, and they would have been ruined if we hadn't gone that particular night. So as far as the camp was concerned, everything was fairly normal, except that we knew what was going on, and all our colleagues and friends who were on due to go out were assembled in this particular hut. All went well, of course, until the RAF decided to bomb Berlin that night. And as we'd got electric light inside the tunnels, the Germans switched all the lights off, including all the boundary lights, and the chaps who were down the tunnel got left with no light, no illumination. So they fairly quickly tried to get the what we call goon lamps, which were melted down margarine, which gave a fat which we could burn with wicks to light the tunnels up. But I think the raid lasted about an hour, and we lost a tremendous lot of time in getting people out, which was probably good from the point of view of the fact that we probably saved a lot of lives, as it happens. And then, of course, after the lights had been switched on, eventually the tunnel was discovered by one of the guards who wanted to relieve himself around the perimeter. The tunnel had come out rather closer to the fence than we anticipated due to an error in surveying, which was...
Due to a what?
Error in surveying. Of course, it was done with fairly primitive equipment, and we came out about 20 yards too early. So everybody who came out had to be led from there into the woods. A man who got up to the top of the tunnel, top of the shaft, and we had a rope which we laid down, or the first man laid down into the woods, and each man felt his way along this rope. And they continued in this vein. But unfortunately, as I say, one of the guards decided to relieve himself and walked around, and he came right to the edge of the opening with one or two of the escapees just emerging. They froze at that spot. Nothing happened for the moment. But eventually the guard spotted something and... realised that there was an escape on, and then all hell was let loose. The screaming, as usual, of the Germans took place, and then the Chief Ferrets and Chief Abwehr officers, the security officers, arrived, and they were very highly strung, to say the least of it. The chief one, Chief Ferret, who was known as Rubberneck, really lost his temper because he was virtually in charge of the security arrangements, and they hadn't found this tunnel. So he was waving a Tommy gun around, and of course we were all dragged out of our huts in the middle of the night, and we spent the rest of the night having checks made on who was there and who wasn't. The one of the ferrets.